from across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
Welcome to the Aero Society Channel, brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with IPA Media. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society Channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Flight Test Group. It's delightful to see so many people here, and I think the this evening's subject will justify the interest. Usual important notice to start with: if the fire alarm goes off, it really means it, and leave as quickly as possible by a suitable exit. This evening we're going to hear about the Boeing flight tests on the 747-8 and the Boeing 787, the Dreamliner, which is at the very cutting edge of development in aviation at present. Our speaker is Captain Frank Santoni, the Chief Test Pilot of Boeing, who heads a team of test pilots, engineers and support staff. Thinking about it, he must head a department that's bigger than most of our aircraft companies. And he's responsible for overseeing the flight safety and progress of the flight testing of Boeing aircraft. He's had an impressive career. He was chief test pilot for the Boeing 777 program, which is a very successful program. And he's cleared to fly just about everything that's got a 7 on the end of it. The thing that struck me about his biography was that he's a former US Navy pilot flying A-4s and A-6s off the USS Kitty Hawk. Now, naval pilots tend to count their experience in not in terms of hours, but in terms of the number of deck landings they've done. And if you've done 100 deck landings, you're known as a centurion. And to be a centurion is a little bit special. Frank isn't a centurion. He's a double centurion. He's got something like 250 deck landings. He must be good if he survived that lot. So, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Frank Santoni.
First of all, it's a real pleasure to be here. I've been looking for this opportunity to come over and talk about our test programs for quite a while, actually about a year ago. I'm glad I didn't come over about a year ago because I have a whole lot more to tell you right now than a year ago. A year ago, we didn't have a lot to talk about. Tonight, we have a lot to talk about. So I hope you'll find it interesting. A couple of things. The videos I'm going to show you are special videos that are proprietary to Flight Test. I've had authorization to show these to this audience. So I please ask you not to take any pictures of them so that we can view them. I think you'll find it very interesting. Also, there's going to be a little bit of audience participation, so I'm going to ask you some questions so we can, because I know there's a lot of answers to be had out there. As a matter of fact, I've flown with a number of the pilots out here in the audience, which I was surprised. I didn't know they were coming. So I used to like to ask, what is the audience out there, so I knew who I'm talking to. So first of all, how many pilots are out here in the audience? Okay, how many test pilots? Okay, they're the ones that are going to have the hard questions I'm going to ask. How about test engineers? We have flight test engineers. Great. And how many have never flown an airplane before in their life? All right, good. That helps. You guys are going to want to fly after you're here tonight. Okay. So what I'm going to talk about is an update for the 747-8 and the 787 program. It's going to last about 45 minutes or so, maybe an hour, and then we could have some questions afterwards, as long as they're not too hard, okay? We'll talk about the 478, the 787-8, and then a little bit of interest about the 787-8 crew training. Okay, the 747-8, okay, it's an airplane that's coming out in the freighter version first. We're testing the freighter version. We have four airplanes in the test inventory. Those are the four you see there that are called RC-501, 521, 522, and 503. Those are pictures of the freighter and the intercontinental version. The intercon, you can see, has a bigger upper deck The freighter version is a little smaller upper deck. The Iracon will start flying in the next couple of months in the test inventory. So what is this airplane? What, you know, why do we do a 747-8 when we have the 747-400 out there? Well, it's an opportunity to take advantage of some of the technologies we have out there in the 787 and make the 747-8 more competitive. So to give you an idea how the two compare, whereas the 747-400 is 875,000-pound takeoff gross weight, the 747-8 is 975,000, almost 1 million pounds. The length of it is about 19 feet longer. It's 250 feet compared to 231 feet. The wingspan's a little wider, 224 compared to 211. The engines are a little bigger. They're GE engines on this airplane, and they are about 66,000 pounds of thrust compared to somewhere around 63 for the old 400. Since we stretched the airplane, made it longer, it seats more people, typically about 470 people in a three-class version compared to about 420 on the 47-400. Give you an idea of the size. It goes a little bit faster. The 47-400 cruised between 8.4 and 8.5. This will cruise between 8.45 and 8.55, just a little bit faster. You get that with the new wing, and you get that with stretching the airplane a little bit. The real advantage, one of the big advantages, we put a brand new wing on this airplane. So you take a 47-400, slap a brand new wing on it, and put 787 engines on it, and you get a 13% improvement in seat mile cost. 13% is just amazingly large for an airplane of this vintage. The 787 we'll talk about in a little while is a 20% advantage with a brand new airplane. So you take a 47-400, do this to it, and you get 13% better seat mileage. That's why we did it. It's 10% lighter per seat, and the range is a little bit longer than the 47-400. It's about 8,000 nautical miles. So pretty capable airplane. Mostly we're sold in freighters right now. We've got two customers for the Intercontinental. Commercially, we've got Lufthansa and Korean Air. And they'll be starting to fly those in a couple those test airplanes in a couple of months. In the test program, 600 flights and about 1,600 flight hours. So I'm going to start in. Now I'm going to talk about first flight. So I'm going to show you a video of the first flight of the airplane. It's an exciting time at the Boeing Company. You can imagine this. This is happening right after this, 787. And we are really excited. The whole factory empties. I'll show you that. So things I want you to think about, and I'm going to ask you afterwards, what are the two things the pilot worries about on first flight? So think about what two things. And I asked the pilots before they went out and flew it, what are you worried about? Tell me the two things. And I want to see what you think it is. I want you to look at the size. You'll see it taxi by some people when we go here. You'll see a lot of people on the runway. Actually, the factory shuts down for first flight. There's no sense having anybody in the factory. They're all going to leave anyhow. We talked to the guy. We talked to the factory supervisor. Said, the flight's going to fly early, 10 o'clock or so in the morning. We've got airplanes to deliver. We've got airplanes to make. You're not going to make your delivery schedule. He said, Frank, don't worry about it. Those people get so pumped up by the time they come back, they get twice as much work done in the half a day they have when they come back. So it's a real motivational thing for the team. And then when it takes off, I want you to look for a shortish gray kind of guy waving at the airplane. And tell me who you think that is. Kind of our flight test delivery, it smiles at you as it comes out of the taxi. If you haven't been to Seattle in the middle of February, you have a day like this, it's pretty extraordinary. It's a beautiful day, very sunny. This is Everett Field, Payne Field in Everett, about 30 miles north of Seattle. It's where we build the airplane. I'm going to ask you another question. Look at the engine. Do you see something on the back of the engine? It looks like little scallops. I'm going to ask you what that is, too. Yes, guys, look at the landing and see if you notice anything as he's rolling out.
I have to especially thank the engineering team. You've just done a superb job. And the factory build team, the airplane is a beautiful airplane.
It's just a tremendous privilege and honor to be associated not just with the legacy of the 47, but with the future of the 47.
Okay, so first of all, did anybody notice the short guy with the gray hair? You know who that was? Joe Sutter. Joe Sutter, the original designer, chief engineer of the 747, period. Back in 1969, 1970. Joe still has an office at Boeing. He comes out to all the big events, and we always see Joe. I was going to ask a couple questions. On the engines, you notice the engines had a kind of a scallop thing on the back of them? It looks kind of cool, but that's not what it's there for. Cool doesn't buy it on airplanes. Anybody know? It's noise. Turns out, when the air comes out of the engines, it creates noise. It's just jet engine noise. But if you mix, if you have this shape on it, it mixes the air behind the engine as it bypasses with the engine internal combustion gases coming out, and it reduces the noise. We found that out on a number of programs. So most of the engines you're going to see in modern jet.
From across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
Welcome to the Aero Society Channel. Brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with IPA Media. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Flight Test Group. It's delightful to see so many people here, and I think the this evening's subject will justify the interest. Important notice to start with: if the fire alarm goes off, it really means it, and leave as quickly as possible by a suitable exit. This evening we're going to hear about the Boeing flight tests on the 747-8 and the Boeing 787, the Dreamliner, which is at the very cutting edge of development in aviation at present. Our speaker is Captain Frank Santoni, the Chief Test Pilot of Boeing, who heads a team of test pilots, engineers, and support staff. Thinking about it, he must head a department that's bigger than most of our aircraft companies. And he's responsible for overseeing the flight safety and progress of the flight testing of Boeing aircraft. He's had an impressive career. He was Chief Test Pilot for the Boeing 777 program, which is a very successful program. And he's cleared to fly just about everything that's got a 7 on the end of it. The thing that struck me about his biography was that he's a former US Navy pilot flying A-4s and A-6s off the USS Kitty Hawk. Now, naval pilots tend to count their experience in not in terms of hours, but in terms of the number of deck landings they've done. And if you've done 100 deck landings, you're known as a centurion. And to be a centurion is a little bit special. Frank isn't a centurion. He's a double centurion. He's got something like 250 deck landings. He must be good if he survived that lot. So, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Frank Santoni.
First of all, it's a real pleasure to be here. I've been looking for this opportunity to come over and talk about our test programs for quite a while, actually about a year ago. I'm glad I didn't come over about a year ago because I have a whole lot more to tell you right now than a year ago. A year ago, we didn't have a lot to talk about. Tonight, we have a lot to talk about. So I hope you'll find it interesting. A couple of things. The videos I'm going to show you are special videos that are proprietary to Flight Test. I've had authorization to show these to this audience, so I please ask you not to take any pictures of them so that we can view them. I think you'll find them very interesting. Also, there's going to be a little bit of audience participation, so I'm going to ask you some questions so we can, because I know there's a lot of answers to be had out there. As a matter of fact, I've flown with a number of the pilots out here in the audience, which I was surprised. I didn't know they were coming. So I used to like to ask, what is the audience out there, so I knew who I'm talking to. So first of all, how many pilots are out here in the audience? Okay, how many test pilots? Okay, they're the ones who are going to have the hard questions I'm going to ask. How about test engineers? We have flight test engineers. Great. And how many have never flown an airplane before in their life? All right, good. That helps. You guys are going to want to fly after you're here tonight. Okay. So what I'm going to talk about is an update for the 7478 and the 787 program. It's going to last about 45 minutes or so, maybe an hour, and then we can have some questions afterwards, as long as they're not too hard. Okay. We're talking about the 478, the 787-8. And then a little bit of interest about the 787-8 crew training. Okay, the 747-8, okay, it's an airplane that's coming out in the freighter version first. We're testing the freighter version. We have four airplanes in the test inventory. Those are the four you see there that are called RC-501, 521, 522, and 503. Those are pictures of the freighter and the intercontinental version. The intercon, you can see, has a bigger upper deck. The freighter version is a little smaller upper deck. The intercon will start flying in the next couple of months in the test inventory. So what is this airplane? Why do we do a 747-8 when we have the 747-400 out there? Well, it's an opportunity to take advantage of some of the technologies we have out there in the 787 and make the 747-8 more competitive. So to give you an idea how the two compare, whereas the 747-400 is 875,000 pound takeoff gross weight, the 747-8 is 975,000, almost 1 million pounds. The length of it is about 19 feet longer. It's 250 feet compared to 231 feet. The wingspan's a little wider. 224 compared to 211. The engines are a little bigger. They're GE engines on this airplane, and they are about 66,000 pounds of thrust compared to somewhere around 63 for the old 400. Since we stretched the airplane, made it longer, it seats more people, typically about 470 people in a three-class version compared to about 420 on the 747-400. Give you an idea of the size. It goes a little bit faster. The 47400 cruised between 84 and 85. This will cruise between 845 and 855, just a little bit faster. You get that with the new wing, and you get that with stretching the airplane a little bit. The real advantage, one of the big advantages, we put a brand new wing on this airplane. So you take a 47400, slap a brand new wing on it, and put 787 engines on it, and you get a 13% improvement in seat mile cost. 13% is just amazingly large for an airplane of this vintage. The 787 we'll talk about in a little while is a 20% advantage of a brand new airplane. So you take a 47400, do this to it, and you get 13% better seat mileage. That's why we did it. It's 10% lighter per seat, and the range is a little bit longer than the 47400. It's about 8,000 nautical miles. So pretty capable airplane. Mostly we're sold in freighters right now. We've got two customers for the Intercontinental. Commercially, we've got Lufthansa and Korean Air, and they'll be starting to fly those those test airplanes in a couple of months. In the test program, 600 flights and 600 flights and about 1,600 flight hours. So I'm going to start in. Now I'm going to talk about first flight. So I'm going to show you a video of the first flight of the airplane. It's an exciting time at the Boeing Company. You can imagine this. This is happening right after this, 787, and we are really excited. The whole factory empties. I'll show you that. So things I want you to think about, and I'm going to ask you afterwards, what are the two things the pilot worries about on first flight? So think about what two things. And I asked the pilots before they went out and flew it, what are you worried about? Tell me the two things. And I want to see what you think it is. I want you to look at the size. You'll see it taxi by some people when we go here. You'll see a lot of people on the runway. Actually, the factory shuts down for first flight. There's no sense having anybody in the factory. They're all going to leave anyhow. We talked to the guy. We talked to the factory supervisor. Said, the flight's going to fly early, 10 o'clock or so in the morning. We've got airplanes to deliver. We've got airplanes to make. You're not going to make your delivery schedule. He said, Frank, don't worry about it. Those people get so pumped up by the time they come back, they get twice as much work done in the half a day they have when they come back. So it's a real motivational thing for the team. And then when it takes off, I want you to look for a shortish gray kind of guy waving at the airplane. And tell me who you think that is. Of our flight test delivery, it smiles at you as it comes out of the taxi. If you haven't been to Seattle in the middle of February and have a day like this, it's pretty extraordinary. It's a beautiful day, very sunny. This is Everett Field, Payne Field in Everett, about 30 miles north of Seattle. It's where we built the airplane. I'm going to ask you another question. Look at the engines. You see something on the back of the engines. It looks like little scallops. I'm going to ask you what that is, too. Guys, look at the landing and see if you notice anything as he's rolling out.
I have to especially thank the engineering team. You've just done a superb job, and the factory build team. The airplane is a beautiful airplane.
It's just a tremendous privilege and honor to be associated not just with the legacy of the 47, but with the future of the 47.
So first of all, did anybody notice the short guy with the gray hair? You know who that was? Joe Sutter. Joe Sutter, the original designer, chief engineer of the 747, period, back in 1969, 1970. Joe still has an office at Boeing. He comes out to all the big events, and we always see Joe. I was going to ask a couple questions. On the engines, you notice the engines had a kind of a scallop thing on the back of them? It looks kind of cool, but that's not what it's there for. Cool doesn't buy it on airplanes. Anybody know? It's noise. Turns out, when the air comes out of the engines, it creates noise. It's just jet engine noise. But if you have this shape on it, it mixes the air behind the engine as it bypasses with the engine internal combustion gases coming out, and it reduces the noise. We found that out on a number of programs. So most of the engines you're going to see in modern jets will probably have those scallops. Okay, on landing, did anybody notice anything? Real keen? Pitch up? You notice when it touched down, it pitched up a little bit? And that's due to the fact that the spoilers aren't configured correctly in this one. It's not unusual to have that happen. So when you touch down, the spoilers come up to reduce the lift on the wing, get the weight on the wheels, and it changes the lift distribution on the wing. And if you don't do them right, it tends to pitch the nose up. So what we have to do is reprogram the spoilers to prevent that pitch up, and we've already done that. So that's one thing we found on the first flight. So that was interesting. Okay, so I was going to ask you, what do pilots worry about in first flight? Embarrass themselves? That's really close. I'm not kidding. Yeah, whether you get the pitch trim calculation right, that's another good one to worry about. They find that out on the taxi test. We actually bring the nose up on the taxi test to check that's right. That was the day before, but that's one you'd worry about. There's one more out here.
Get down in one piece.
Get down in one piece. One piece is always good. A million pieces is really good, all working together. Okay, so. So I asked Mark Feierstein, who was our chief pilot, I said, Mark, what are you worried about going out there? He said, first of all, I'm worried about the landing. He said, I'm going to have millions of people around the world watching this landing for years, and it's better be good because they're going to be seeing this picture forever. So he was worried about that. And then the second one, he wasn't worried about how it flew. He was worried about what he was going to say to the media so he would embarrass himself. So what's the script I'm going to talk to the media? They had a great flight. They also found one other thing on the first flight, that there was too much flap buffet and the landing flaps. When they put the landing flaps down, there was just so much buffet, they decided not to land at the full landing flap. They actually landed at a flap that's a little bit less than that. We've since corrected that. It happened to be a landing gear door fairing that wasn't canted quite correctly into the windscreen, and when the flaps came all the way out, we got some buffet from the landing gear door to the flaps. So that's been corrected. So interesting things you find out on first flight. Okay. Stall. I know some of you have never flown before, and flight test guys all know what stalls are. I've actually flown stalls with some of the people out here in the audience. So stall on an airplane is when it flies so slow that there's not enough air over the wing to produce lift and the airplane stops flying. So we do stall testing in all different flap configurations for the airplanes, and we do initial airworthiness stalls before we put actually any people on board. I'm going to show you an initial airworthiness stall on the 7478. Pretty neat, but pretty unexciting. So what does a stall feel like? Who here has stalled airplanes? Jock, you can't talk on the internet. So what does it feel like in a full stall?
Horrible.
Okay. Who stalled a light airplane? So light airplanes, you have a pretty high frequency buffet, and it lets you know normally. Large airplane like a 747 is not like that at all. It's a very low frequency pounding buffet that actually pulls you out of your seat. If you weren't strapped in, you'd get bounced out of your seat. It's kind of like riding a mechanical bull in a bar. It's a very pounding frequency, and you feel it with the flaps up. With the flaps down, there's hardly any buffet at all. So what I'm going to show you here is a stall where there's not too much buffet felt in the cockpit, but the pilots will actually be doing a turning stall in a 7478, pulling the stick full aft and holding it in their lap for 2 seconds, and you'll see the results. This is the number one 7478. It's a turning stall being chased by a T-33. You can barely see the elevator here. He's actually pulling full aft into a stall. The elevator is full up. There's a little buffet going on, and that's a stall. That's about as exciting as it gets in the 478. Sorry about that, but those are the stall characteristics we really want. We've had airplanes in the past that have actually turned over on their backs because stall characteristics aren't very good. 7478 has very docile stall characteristics. We've done hundreds and almost maybe close to 1,000 stalls, and they've all been really good. They do buffet like crazy when the flap's up, but that's what it's supposed to be. Okay. This is a very interesting test. It's called water spray testing. I'm going to show you an airplane, a 747, going through a water trough. And we do water spray for a number of reasons. Can anybody think about what you do water spray for? Ingestion. So as the nose, so think about it. If you're in a very wet runway and with puddles and maybe more than puddles, and the nose gear goes through these, it sprays up a lot of water. And you don't want this water going into an engine and flaming the engine out. That's not a good thing. You don't want going into other cavities where water could do bad things and cause problems with the airplane. So what we do is we artificially set up a swimming pool, basically, with rubber mats around it, and run an airplane through about 3 inches of water at various speeds. And I'm going to show you that. So one of the things you're going to see is the pool. You're going to, and I may run this twice because it's kind of cool. And you're going to hear some audio at the end. I want you to think about who that audio is from. I want you to look at this swimming pool. It's made by rubber dams around this 3 inches of water, and the nose gear will go through it, destroy the pool on one side and on the other. And then watch where the mains go up with the side of the pool. Now, this pool takes a while to construct, so think about that. Think about the guys constructing it. And then just watch it. I'll show this a couple times because it's kind of fun. We actually do this in an airport we own in central Montana called Glasgow. It's an old Air Force base. Look here and look here. This is different views. Here's a one view, a front view, and you'll see it come in. Here's that swimming pool I was talking about.
Go.
Okay. Who's saying go? Somebody had it. Cameraman. He's sitting there right in front, taking pictures of that, and he has another guy standing here because the one guy's fixating to get the good videos, and we've learned that when you fixate on something, you don't realize there's an airplane bearing down on you necessarily. So the guy's job here is to say go, and get the heck out of there. You notice they kind of destroy the pool. I'm going to show it again. Look at the main gear. The main gear just trucked down just barely on the outside of that, and they have to go through this 3 or 4 or 5 times in a day. And so they want to reconstruct it. So the pilot really has to keep it on center line. The engineers constantly talk about that because they don't want to have to construct the side of the pool again. So we'll watch that again. And then look at the pink stuff on the airplane, too. That's kind of interesting. Notice the colors here. Here's the main gear, and here's the side of the swimming pool.
Go.
Photographers protecting themselves. They construct the pool big enough so they get enough water, and that pink stuff is it's like a commercial cleanser. We call it Bonami. Ajax is another type, and you mix it up into a paste with water, and then you put a food dye on it, and you paint it all over the airplane. And after you're done, you can actually see where the water went. It's very cheap and non-corrosive way to make good engineering judgment. If you think about it, do you think it's better to? Do you think the water spray is better, faster, or slower going through the pool? Any ideas? I just kind of set you up. There's an optimum speed, and you have to find it. When you go through really fast, it doesn't spray it as much. You go through really slow, it doesn't drive enough energy. So at about 80 to 85 knots of airspeed or ground speed is where we had the worst spray. And we actually find that out by doing multiple tests through that. And then the pilot's job is to get that exact speed with the engines at full thrust when it happens, because we want to see the engines producing takeoff thrust at 80 knots. And so later on, I'm going to show you the 787. You watch them. They'll actually tap the brakes before they go into the pool just so they get the speed exactly right. A little bit challenging. Okay, VMU, velocity minimum unstick. Okay, I'm going to show this a couple times too because it's kind of neat. So the idea here is to find out what speed an airplane will come off the ground in its best geometry you can give. So what we do here is we take the airplane down the runway, rotate it to put the tail on the ground, scrape it on the ground, and wait till the airplane lifts off. It's called minimum unstick. You can't get any better than that. It's a minimum speed at which an airplane will lift off. And we do it at different flap settings, and we also do it at different thrust ratings and different thrust to weights. Pretty exciting. So I'm going to show you this, and I want you to think about, can the pilot feel it? Can the pilot feel it being 250 feet away up in front of the airplane? And what is that thing made out of? It's a series of VMUs. This is a high thrust. It barely gets a tail on the ground, and it'll get airborne fairly quick. That's what we call the tail skid. There's a series of these with decreasing thrust to weight. So we'll load the airplane up and we'll just adjust the thrust to get a different thrust to weight ratio. So as if simulating a very heavy airplane. You can generally get the nose up at about 90 knots and then kind of put it where you want. You don't want to get the tail on the ground too early because you scrape the skid off and that's not good for the structure of the airplane. The other thing, I always think about the photographers. Those guys are sitting down there about midfield. When this airplane comes by, sometimes the wing vortices that they take off actually knock them to the ground. Pretty low thrust to weight, not climbing really spectacularly. Normally you put the gear up, but we hold that in that configuration until about 200 feet. And the condition's off. Okay, do you think the pilots felt that up front? 250, I have somebody shaking their head, no? Anybody else? No, no, they can. I'm gonna ask you the same thing when we go to the 787. You can actually feel it. It has something to do with the long, big tube. Maybe it's the freighter, because it's pretty empty in back, but the pilots all said they could feel the tail when it was on the ground. And what's that made out of? What's that tail skid made out of? Wood, made out of wood. It's a very hard wood. We used to make it out of oak laminates. I think this is called purple wood, is what it's called. It's a South American, very hard, very dense wood. They can generally get 2 to 3 VMUs out of a block of wood, depending how long the pilot drags it on the ground. The trick on this one is to take off in an exactly 3-point configuration. You get the nose set and don't let it come up anymore when you take off. And then they use that speed, that VMU speed, the minimum unstick speed, to define your liftoff speed. Okay, your liftoff speed has to be like 5-10% above the VMU speed. Okay. So it defines what we allow the pilots to lift off with. So it's one of the speeds we use in the calculation for speeds for these airplanes. So that's why we do VMUs. And it's actually one of the more fun things to do in an airplane. I mean, think about it. They let you take a $200 million airplane and play with it all day and just drag the tail on the ground. I mean, how neat is that? I got to do it on the 777. I didn't get to do this one, but we can only let so many guys have fun. Okay, 478, we're going to leave that. We're going to go on to our exciting other airplane here, the 787, the Dash 8 and the Dash 9. We're flying the Dash 8 right now, in case anybody's interested. The Dash 8 is about the same size as a 767. So if you know what a 767 is, you kind of know the size of this airplane. It's a little bigger fuselage on the inside and a little longer, but about the same size. It's got more range than a 767. It's got range out to almost a 777-200 range. And it's got engines that are in the class of about 66,000 pounds of thrust. The Dash 9 will come out next year, in 2012. It's a little bigger airplane. It's got three classes. It's got more range. And we think it'll be as a bigger seller eventually than this. Right now, this is selling about two to one over this, but we've got quite a few orders for this one, too. These airplanes are similar, but they're not as similar as some of our earlier model airplanes. So I'm going to explain that a little bit. When we designed, for example, the 777, we came out with the 777 in 1994, and its gross weight was about 506,000 pounds when we designed it and built it then. It has since grown to 775,000 pounds of weight, with essentially the same wing, a little bit bigger wing, but not a whole lot of difference. So you might think that's really neat. I mean, we can build an airplane back in the early 90s that we can just build on and build on and build on and make it bigger and bigger. What it tells us, or told the Boeing designers, is that we didn't get to the optimum design for the 777-300ER until about 12 or 13 years later with the same airframe we started with. So why don't we just start with an airframe optimally designed from the start? So this airplane is optimum from the start. It's where the 777-300ER is now. Doesn't have a lot of growth in it, but it is optimally designed, and that's one of the reasons you get so much performance out of that airplane. You get a lot of performance out of the engines, you get a lot of performance out of the new wing, a lot of performance out of the composites. You put them all together, you get about 20%, and you optimally design that airplane. And this airplane is different than that airplane because we're going to optimum design each different airplane. It's a different model on how you build airplanes. Really successful? Most successful airplane we've ever had. Right now there's 847 orders from 57 customers. If you're an airline and don't see your name up here, you got to wait till about 2015 to get your name on here because they're that backloaded. And people always ask, are we having cancellations? And we have cancellations for various reasons. Either, you know, the airline's not ready or they've had a different financial outlook. But the interest has stayed high. We haven't had a much difference in the order backlog. We've moved customers around. We've had some cancellations, but we've had some reorders too. Kind of as we went around for the year, we started initial airworthiness in January. We did flutter testing in March. We did a lot of stuff in March. We did ground effects in March, ultimate wing tests where we actually bent the wing. That's, you can see there in the test rig where we're bending the wing up till ultimate load. We expanded our type inspection authorization from the FAA in 2010. We did extreme weather. We actually did extreme weather in a hangar in Florida. Cold weather in Florida, right? But they have an extreme weather temp hangar at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. We did icing testing in May. Just barely got natural ice done in May before the weather turned nice in Seattle. We have airplane 5 flying. We have airplane 6 flying. And just recently, we had airplane 8 flying. 7 hasn't flown yet. 8's flying. We've got about 874 flights right now. This was updated as of yesterday, about 2,655 flight hours, 75% into the flight test program. About 3,000 hours and we're finished the flight test program. So we're getting there. It's a little slower than we've liked, but we're getting there. I'll have to update this one because there's actually 7 airplanes in the flight test program now. And we test everywhere. We test hot, cold, wet, short hops, long range flights. We are quickly moving into an area where most of the primary testing is done. We're going to move into an area where we're going to do ETOPS testing and FNR testing, functionality and reliability testing, where we'll take an airplane that's very representative of one we're going to put into service and we'll put it into its test program. Okay. 787 flight deck. So I'm going to ask you a couple questions here. The pilot's going to get in the cockpit, and I ask every one of our pilots this question when I fly with them. What are the first two things that strike you about this cockpit? And I'm going to talk about it for a little bit, and then you tell me what you think strikes you about it. We have heads-up displays right here. A heads-up display, if you're not familiar with it, fighter guys always use them. It's a display of the primary flight instruments that we show down here that are superimposed on a piece of glass that sits in front of the pilot. So you can actually look at your primary flight displays and look through them and see the real world behind them. Dual heads-up displays, standard on the airplane. If you buy this airplane, you get them. If you want to take them off, we charge you to take them off. There are certain airlines that don't like that answer, but that's the way it is. We have a standard airplane and you get dual HUDs. We have 5 very large displays. They're liquid crystal displays. They're commercially off-the-shelf glass driven by very sophisticated hardware. We have wheel and column. We do not have side sticks, okay? There are some other manufacturers that build airplanes with side sticks. We don't build toys. No, don't quote that. We build wheel and column airplanes because we think it's the right thing to do for the Boeing family. There are other models out there. There are other manufacturers that build airplanes with different types of controllers. This controller works for our model family airplanes. It works for going from a 777 to this airplane. I'll explain why that's important later on. And it works for other things in the company. And I have an hour's worth lecture on that, but I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to bore you with that tonight, okay? We have our CDUs, our control display units, how you operate the flight management computer, are soft keys. It's like a touchpad, but not, and that's to allow for expansion. They're not a hard key there. We have a cursor control device. You know on your laptops, the little touchpad you have? That's what this is. And you put your finger on there, and it controls a cursor on all these displays, and you get different functionality from drop-down menus. On the side here, we have the thing called electronic flight bag. An electronic flight bag will show all your approach plates. It will show your performance information. It will show your ops manuals and your other information that the company may want you to have. We have a standard throttle. We have a standard flap lever. The throttles move. They're auto throttles. And what else? I think those are the major things I'd want to point out on the cockpit. The other interesting things about the airplane is traditional airplanes today, for air conditioning, they use air from the engine. They actually take bleed air, they call it, off the engine, run it through an air conditioning pack, cool it down, and make air. This airplane does not take any bleed air from the engines. It's an all-electric airplane. So we actually take outside air, run them through compressors, and cool the airplane with those. So the engines, it's a no-bleed configuration. First time we've ever done that, and it's working very well. The only bleed air extraction we use for the airplane is for engine anti-ice, just to heat the cowl. So that makes it really interesting. It's got the most advanced fly-by-wire system ever developed for a commercial airplane. Some of the features that it has, which are different, and I'm going to talk to you just shortly about it. I'd bore you to tears with this one. But it'll come into play in some of the videos I'm going to show. In the roll axis, conventionally when you roll the wheel, you're actually making the airplane roll by moving ailerons and spoilers on the wings. This airplane, when you move the control wheel, you're actually controlling a roll rate. You're telling the computer, I want to roll at a certain rate. So that's a slight difference. In a conventional airplane, when you kick the rudder, you're actually moving the rudder pedals. You're actually moving the rudder via hydraulics or direct linkage to make the airplane yaw left or right. In this airplane, when you move the rudder pedals, you're commanding side slip. You're commanding the airplane to do a certain left or right side slip. If you don't touch the rudder pedals, you're commanding the airplane to zero side slip. And if something would happen on that airplane, like you lose an engine or you have some sort of surface not work right, the airplane would still maintain zero side slip and put the rudder in for you automatically. That makes sense? I know it makes sense to some. What's the heck's he talking about? Okay. All right, what are the two things? Two things a pilot would say that they think are got their attention.
Change the color.
So it you're a forced Boeing guy. 674?
Commercial pilot.
Okay. The color's gray, okay? If you've been in a 5767, 777, 47400, it was brown. We went, in the late 70s, we went earth colors, okay? We went brown on the airplane. So they wanted a product differentiator, so they went back and went gray. I don't know why, but the airplane's gray. But that's not it, though. Good one, though. Good catch. That's not what the first...
Big screens?
Do you think that would be one? But we have pretty big screens on our other airplanes. That's not the one our guys are picking out. Seats? The seats are cool, but they're not one of the things. Right here. Heads-up display. That's the first thing people say. Boy, dual heads-up display, very unusual. The second one, and I set you up a little bit this, and you can't see it here. This window is the largest window we've ever made on an airplane. And because normally we had a window here and a window there, we took the center post out, and now it's one big, huge picture window. The guys sit in there, and I swear, they just sit there and look out, and they go, wow, they can really see out that. So two things they really see are the HUDs and that, and then they get into this stuff down here. It's interesting. I just asked one of a pilot I just flew with the other day for the first time, and he didn't say the big picture window. He said the HUD, and then he said the CDU. Compass? Well, there's a wet compass up here. There's still one area. We have to have it. FAR, federal regulation. There was another question. Can you what? No, you cannot. Windows don't open in this. Don't open. It was weight. It was noise. We have a hatch that sits right up there, and you go out the hatch with an inertia reel like you do on a 747. Okay, so let's go on. Okay, 787 water spray. You saw it on the 47. You're going to see it on the 87. And watch how he barely taps the brakes when he goes into the trough. The 47 actually went first. They did their water spray first. 787 went a couple weeks later. You get an idea how big those engines are compared to the fuselage? See him? Okay, I'm going to go into minimum control ground speed. So what is this? So we have to test that the airplane speed while they're going down the runway, the pilot can control to stay on the runway if they lose an engine. It's a good thing for the traveling public. If you lose an engine, you want the pilots to be able to stay on the runway. So when the normal takeoff, the pilot has a speed called V1, which is their decision speed. At V1, they decide, am I going to take off or am I going to stop on the runway? Prior to V1, we assume that if you lose an engine, the pilot will stop, and he'll be able to control because both engines are at idle, and there's not a big controllability problem. After V1, the pilot's going to go fly, and if they lose an engine, then they're going to continue to fly, you know, on the remaining engines. So to do that, we want them to maintain the center line of the runway. It's a good thing to happen, believe me. And so we test for that. So I'm going to give you, this is, I'm sorry, it's not a Boeing airplane, but that's all we have. So VMCG is the minimum speed that the pilot can control on the runway when they lose an engine. And that's defined as when you lose an engine, the airplane will deviate only 30 feet and you can continue. So we have to decide where that is, and we actually test for that. And to test for that, if you pretend my tie is the runway, okay? Use your imagination, please. And it's a twin-engine airplane, say, and I'm going to fail. If the airplane's going this way, I'm going to fail this engine over on this side, right? The airplane, because this engine's pushing so much thrust, will go like that, right? Now, the pilot, to control it, will kick the rudder to move the nose that direction, all right? So what we have to do is, in this test, is you take the airplane to a certain speed, the pilot not flying fails an engine. If he fails this engine, it goes this way, and then the pilot flying immediately puts in full rudder, I mean, as fast as they can do it. Half a second is a good time to have. And then the nose starts coming this way. Unfortunately, the airplane's still going that way because it hasn't turned around, and eventually the airplane will do that. Okay, so VMCG, this engine fails, it goes like this, pilot puts in full rudder, the airplane starts that way, and then it goes that way, and when this center of gravity is 30 feet from the center line where we started, they declare that the VMCG speed. Did I lose anybody? Make sense? Okay, so we make the pilot's life more interesting than that. We not only we're going to do this, we're going to fail the nose gear steering. So we're simulating an icy or a wet runway. So you line up on the runway, you fail the nose gear steering, you go down to the critical speed, you fail the engine, and then you control the airplane. So I'll show it to you. I'll show it to you a couple times, this one for sure. You'll notice the engine failure first because you'll see the rudder go hard over. You'll see that rudder come hard over. Then you'll hear the engine fail because the cameraman's halfway down the runway and sound takes a while to get there. That's the engine failure. That's 30 feet. And that's recovery. Okay, you probably heard the engine fail. In the cockpit, you hear it right away. The pilot in the cockpit is not allowed to react to the sound. The engine really surges. It's one big bang. The pilot has to react to the nose moving, and sometimes our pilots get really excited and they hear that bang and they just shove in the rudder and we got to do it again. But it's really hard to react in more than faster than half a second. And if we see reaction times like at 0.1 seconds, we usually throw them out and say, okay, you got to react when the nose moves. I'll show you it again. Yes, you did do. It's because we only abuse one engine. It really beats up an engine, so we try to keep it to one engine, and so we really do know which one's going to fail. So that was minimum control speed on the ground. We have to do minimum control speed in the air. I'm going to show you a very unique view of minimum control speed in the air. It's called dynamic minimum control speed in the air, as opposed to static. There's another one called static, but this is the dynamic one. So what we do on this test is we set the airplane up at full thrust in a pretty good climb. In a typical configuration, it would be like a go-around configuration. Full thrust, 20 degrees pitched up, and we failed one of the engines. And then the pilot has to control the airplane to within 20 degrees of the initial heading. All right. So what I'm going to show you here is the pilot flying it. I'm not going to show you the airplane. I'm going to show you the pilot flying it. And watch what happens. Watch his reactions to VMCA. Watch how hard he works. Remember, this airplane is roll rate command, yaw command. So if the pilot does nothing, the airplane is trying to make those corrections. It's Captain Mike Bryan in our typical flight test uniform.
3, 2, cut.
That was obviously the engine failure. Watch his leg activity and his arm activity for an engine for that failure. 66,000 pounds of thrust on one engine, zero on the other. And this is how hard it is to fly. Mike will show off in a second. He tends to do that every night. Come on, hands off. Pretty incredible tools for the pilot. I mean, think about that. This is a very critical event that could happen on a takeoff, and we've done these where we actually full hands off and full feet off, and let's see what the airplane does. And it doesn't do a whole lot more than that. So that's the new fly-by-wire control laws that work for this airplane. Pretty incredible stuff. Crosswinds. Okay. Crosswinds. Where do we find crosswinds? Where's a good place in the world to find crosswinds?
Iceland.
Boy, somebody, you've been there.
I'm not.
Texas. Boeing guy?
Was.
Oh, see. No, Boeing guys aren't supposed to answer the questions. So we did, Iceland. Iceland's a great place to go because it's always windy in Iceland. If you've ever been to Iceland, it just always blows there. They have two runways that are perpendicular to each other, and we go there for crosswinds. This is a 787 in Iceland. Doing a crosswinds in about 25 knots, gusting to 32. So the question here is, what window do you look out? Do you look out the front window? Really not. You're really looking out the side window going that direction. That didn't look like very hard airplane to land in. It isn't. This is a very forgiving airplane in crosswinds. Very forgiving airplane in gusts. Unfortunately, I guess for the program so far, we haven't found the big wind yet. We're actually looking for something around 50 knots. It's amazing around the world, most airports are aligned with the prevailing wind. I don't understand it. Because we really need flight testing to be done. But that just happens that way. If we can find 50 knots, we will. The 777 found 45 knots. We got credit for 38. We've been up to about 28 in this airplane. So we're still looking. Landing performance, any other Navy pilots out here? Okay, Navy pilots love this one. We do landing performance to check brakes, to check that it lands. Okay, that's about a 4 to 6 feet per second landing. This is almost like grabbing a tail hook. As soon as you touch down, you dynamite the brakes. You hit them as hard as you can and bring it to a stop. This stopped with a little bit less than 2,000 feet. And we put a little rubber on the runway. The trick here is to take off really soon after that so you don't blow the fuse plug. So we'll do performance landings for a period of time. Like I said, you hit the brakes as hard as you can. The other test that's really interesting and it gets our test pilots' attention is we do a test where you apply the brakes to full before you touch down. You take the brakes and just bury the brake pedals, and you touch downs with the brakes pushed, and that's really hard to do. Pilots hate to do that. And you just check that the anti-skid does release and you don't blow all the tires. So we've done those tests, and they're working just fine. Brakes, the brakes are carbon brakes, and they're magical stuff. Okay. We saw VMUs on the 478. Let's look at VMUs on the 787. You notice the tail skid is a little different size, just because of the size of the airplane. High thrust to weight, barely got the tail on the ground before they got airborne. I got one more. Here's a low thrust to weight with the 787. I kind of wonder if it's ever going to take off. Not really. So, did you notice there? He was hunting a little bit, right? So, can you feel the tail on the 787? I think I set you up. No, you can't. For some reason, the composite structure wouldn't let the pilots feel the tail, so they couldn't tell if it was on the ground. We put lasers and all that kind of stuff there to try to help you out where it is, but they had a difficult time on the 787 doing VMUs because you didn't have the tactile feel for it. A couple other things on the 787, they have a system called tail strike protection that actually counters the want of the pilot to put the tail on the ground. It actually will put elevator in to oppose them. So there were a couple things going on there. So the VMUs on the 787 were kind of a challenge. They got them done. Okay, max brake energy. So we do these for all the airplanes. We have to show that the brakes have enough energy to stop the airplane at the maximum gross weight, at the maximum energy we could ever put in there. So we fill the airplane up to its maximum weight. We calculate the speed to apply full brakes to get maximum energy. We don't use thrust reversers. And then we do the test. We actually taxi for about 4 miles, do 3 stops, put it at the end of the runway, do a countdown. You run the airplane down the runway. When you hit your cut speed, you dynamite the brakes and hang on. And the test is over in half a second. Because if you don't hit the speed right, you don't get the max energy. If you hit it too late, you go off the runway and you're winding up 5 miles down in a dry lake bed somewhere. And so it's a pretty critical test, and I'll show it to you. The other interesting thing is there's always the brake manufacturer that's sitting there as you're climbing up the stairs. I mean, he's always there and says, good luck, have a good test. And by the way, it's $1 million worth of brakes you're destroying if you blow it. So no pressure. We have two brake manufacturers, Goodrich and Messier Bugatti. This is the Goodrich brake test. We did the next brake the next day. Accelerating down the runway, you'll see the nose dip when he applies the brakes at the right cut speed. Cut speed, by the way, is about 185 knots, 200 plus miles an hour. Watch these brakes. They'll actually start to glow. They're carbon fiber, and they actually turn almost to glass. You see them glowing right in there? Come comes to a stop, you'll actually see some fire kicking up right there. That's not the brakes catching a fire. It's usually dust or grease that comes out of some of the fittings. Very interesting way you passed this test. So the FAA and the Boeing director are standing about where they think this is going to stop, about 12,000, 13,000 feet down the runway. When it stops, the FAA inspector hits a stopwatch. If within 5 minutes the Boeing director does not put out the fire or try to put out the brakes, you pass. So at the end of 5 minutes, he hits a stopwatch, turns his back, said, "You've passed, do whatever you want to the airplane." And that's it. That's how you certify this. So it's up to the guy on the ground, up to the pilots, of course. Do you want them to put this fire out? And it's not really much fire. It's like I said, it's grease and dust. You'll see eventually that there's fuse plugs that actually deflate all the tires, and you can't put anything cold on the tires right now because they'll probably blow, and that's very bad for the firefighters in here. The other thing they do to the pilots to make their life interesting, they take the brakes before you do this test and wear them down till they're 100% worn. They are just paper thin pieces of carbon, and that's what you do it on, 100% worn, because in service, you could actually have that happen to an airline. There you see all the fuse plugs have melted, the fire guys are going in, and they're putting it out. It takes about 8 to 10 full tanker trucks of water to put them out, get the heat off. What they really want to do is get the heat off before the axles start annealing, before they start bending, because we use those same axles the next day for the next test. And the pilots the next day would like it to have them. So the brakes, 100% worn when we did the test. We took the brake pad, we took the carbon off. We looked at it. We could have done the same test again with those same brakes. Incredible technology. In the past, when we used to have steel brakes, when they cooled down, they just broke into hundreds or thousands of little pieces, and everybody got a souvenir. On this one, as soon as they cool down, people are looking all over the place for souvenirs, and you can't find them. You know, you find a little screw here or a little piece there, but they're just really clean. We have thermocouples on the axles, and so we actually measure the temperature, and so we're monitoring with our data system. So if they reach a certain level, we know they've gone to a place where they could anneal or they could deform. And if they don't go beyond a certain level, then they're okay. No, they're gone. They're gone. No. No, we shut the engine down pretty quick.
With the APUs on?
APUs on. That's the noise you were hearing. Okay, that's all the cool videos, but I want to show you a little bit about this here, the pilot training, because it's a really interesting story. We call it pilot qualification plan, how we approve pilots to fly this. So our goal is to have a common type rating between the 777 and 787. And it's really good for the customers because it makes their training courses shorter, and it just makes for more efficiencies. So here's what we do to make that happen. So 90% of the normal procedures are the same as the 777. 90%. So you fly a 777, you can bring it over. The normal checklist you use before you take off and before you land are identical. There's no difference. The procedures that you would use from memory, the ones that if you had a bad thing happen to the airplane and you had to do these by memory, they're identical to the 777. The ones that you don't have to do by memory are reasonably the same, but those you read and do anyhow. And then at the bottom, which is really important, the flight maneuvers are the same. So the way you fly this airplane is the same. You put the gear down the same, you put the flaps down the same, you taxi the same, you do everything exactly the same. We did a handling qualities comparison. We completed that in May of last year. We have pilots from the FAA, from EASA, which is the European Certification Organization, from Japan, from Canada. And we had them all these pilots were 777 qualified. We brought them in for the 787 with no training, and they said it all flew just like the 777. What we get out of that is a 5-day course. If you know how to fly a 777 in 5 days, you can fly the 787. Other Boeing models, if you come from a Boeing glass airplane like a 47 or a 67 or a 37, it takes 13 days to move here. If you come from somewhere else, it takes 20 days to come. So in summary, we've completed all the stuff that we need to do, and the common landing currency is approved. We expect common type rating, and we should get final approval when we certify. First delivery, I have to monitor. So didn't do that. I got to do that for next time. So third quarter now. Third quarter 2011 for first delivery of the 787-8. And the 9 is in 2013. And the team is focused, it's on schedule now, it's looking good. I think it's a reasonable expectation to have airplanes out there by the end of this year. And that's it. So.
From across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
Find more from this series and other events at aerosocietychannel.com. Join over 17,000 members across more than 100 countries and enjoy an excellent range of benefits. Become a member of the Royal Aeronautical Society. See www.aerosociety.com to find out which membership is right for you. This presentation was brought to you by the Royal Aeronautical Society in association with IPermedia. For the usage policy of this and all other content on the Aero Society channel, please review the terms and conditions at aerosocietychannel.com.